This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode 12, and in this episode, we are exploring the world of narrative coaching through the work of Dr. David Drake, who I first kind of discovered, I think it's been several years now, when he was living in Australia, and I came across somehow his work around narrative coaching, and I always kind of watched it from a distance over the last few years. He was doing some interesting things in organizations with narrative practice. But also, he was doing it from a very integrative stance that I, you know, have become increasingly more curious about. Of course, he drew on the work of those of us who are in narrative therapy, you know, that would be quite familiar to us, Michael White, of course, and Jerome Bruner and Vygotsky and Bateson, et cetera. But he was also, he also integrates the work of, well, Jungian psychology through the work of James Hillman and Carl Jung. You know, he's interested in the mind-body connection, specifically work of like Dan Siegel, for example. So he was doing, you know, kind of, you know, this really interesting integrative work around narrative practice in a coaching context. And so so I reached out to him and invited him to have on the show, and he said he would come on. So I'm really excited about that, taking time out of his busy schedule to talk to us. So before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. David Drake. He holds a PhD and is a director of the Center for Narrative Coaching and Leadership in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have partnerships in Sydney, Australia, and Amsterdam. He is the founder of Narrative Coaching and the creator of Narrative Design Labs, which he has run in 12 countries, and the labs provide an experiential introduction to narrative coaching focused on the personal development of the practitioners. David has also designed and delivered narrative-based change, coaching, and leadership projects and programs for over 70 organizations on four continents. His clients include Commonwealth Bank of Australia, Google, Nike, PwC, and the U.S. and Australian federal governments. He has taught coaching skills to over 10,000 leaders, managers, and professionals. He's also a writer. He's the he's an associate editor for Coaching in an International Journal of Theory, Research, and Practice, and the author of over 40 publications on narratives and coaching. He is the editor of the Philosophy and Practice of Coaching. His next books are as author of a book titled Integrative Development, Rethinking How People and Organizations Change, and he will be the co-editor of the SAGE Handbook on Coaching, or of Coaching. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. David Drake. So welcome to the show, Dr. Drake.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm really excited to have you here. I don't know if I communicated this to you when we were setting up this interview, but I've followed you for a while now. I think it's been several years, kind of watching what you've been doing because, well, for several reasons, you're in kind of in the narrative sphere, but also, you know, I've always been curious about coaching because this is, you know, therapy, family therapy has been kind of a second career for me. I came out of the business world and I was always, I'm still kind of involved in it in some ways, but I was always, and I have done some coaching, but I was interested in doing coaching in a different way. And I think that's when I discovered your work. And I was just interested about how this has kind of developed. And now we're at this place where you've just released your book, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Narrative Coaching, Bringing on New Stories to Life, which we'll talk about. But I was really interested in your work, and I've kind of watched this develop over time. So I'm really excited for you and the new book and the possibility with all of that. And so first, thank you for coming and spending some time with me.
You're welcome.
And I guess I want to start just kind of getting some background. How you came into coaching, you know, what your kind of professional life was like.
Well, I suppose like many of us, I think I've instinctively worked this way for a long time, but I didn't really know about coaching until about 20 years ago. So I hold the distinction of holding the first meeting of coaches in Oregon, where I lived at the time, which was quite exciting. And I found it just through a random invitation to an event with a guy, Jay Perry. And I just was intrigued by this idea that you could marry the best of therapeutic or self-development efforts with kind of a more structured developmental process for people. And I had an opportunity through a client to develop a capstone course for a graduate level management program. And because I was graduating the first cohort, I was able to create a course all of my own design. And so I created, in essence, a 4-day coaching skills program long before this was actually very common, and just fell in love with what it did for people and the ability to accelerate development far more than training offered. And so it just sent me off on this journey for the past 20 years to understand coaching more and more.
Interesting. And I think when I discovered you, you were living in Australia.
Yes.
Is that where you got introduced to, I guess, maybe some of the principles of narrative therapy or narrative practice or what have you?
Well, no, actually, I was only there for about 4 years. I was working on a large project and then stayed on for a variety of reasons for a bit. But I mostly got exposed to that in the late 90s. We're starting to work on my PhD and I have come out of a long series of degrees and life experiences that are sort of narrative focused. And so along the way, read a lot of Michael White in particular. I find him the most robust thinker in that space, and I'm really grateful for what he did for right. the world. But many narrative coaches, besides myself, tend to sort of extrapolate from narrative therapy right into coaching. And I do that in a small way, but largely have started from some different orientations, some similar and some different orientations than they have, to create something that's quite unique. So the gift that Australia gave me actually was to give me a playground, if you will, to create the current programs that I offer. And it was through, ironically, or the way life goes sometimes, a difficult period of my own personal life, and use that as an opportunity to begin exploring, could we create some more deeper narrative practices beyond what traditional coaching might offer? And that was really in 2005 when I went to Australia for the first time and introduced my work. That's when I started to realize that I think I was onto something.
Just because of the reaction that you were getting from the people that you were running through these workshops? Or
yeah, especially in the very beginning. My first client actually was a woman who ran a coaching program for a university, for a business school. And she said, I don't think you realize how far ahead of you are in terms of taking a much more contextual and situated approach to development. And it just got really wonderful reviews, and people, I think, appreciated the fact that because it's story-based, it so feels quite natural and human to people, as opposed to a coaching construct that they have to follow.
Right.
And so I think that was very appealing to people.
Right. So I guess that leads me into you do have a lot of, in looking at your book, you do have a lot of familiarity with narrative therapy and
yes.
how that works, but you're doing some really kind of interesting, and something I'm really interested in too, is this kind of integration, and you've done some really interesting integration. And can you say a little bit about that? What you've the framework of your model?
Yeah, the one of the areas where I struggled some for a couple of years was to try to distill this down to its essence and really understand how this approach works in some ways quite differently than other approaches. And most coaching approaches are basically built on a desired structure for a conversation. You know, so the GROW model would be the most famous example of that. And this is the sequence in which we'd like you to talk to people and the way these conversations often progress. And I often found that when people were worried about what model they were using or where they were in the conversation relative to the model, it distracted them from being present to the actual person in conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I designed this model that's an integration of three bodies of work to bring together the sequence with which people tell stories. So just sort of four phases of a story that draws from lots of classic literature on narrative structure.
Right.
And how people tend to talk when they talk about their life. And then realized that that really matched and mirrored quite well the four phases of a rite of passage, which were architecture for the model. This is the process people go through instinctively when they're either wanting to undergo a transition or are in the middle of a transition because of something that's happened.
What you call the four phases, like the situate, search, shift?
And yes.
Shifting? Okay.
Yeah, so that's the core model. It actually scales from one to, I think the largest number we've scaled it to is about 55,000. Helping the CEO of a large bank tell the story about the change that was coming to the bank.
Yeah.
And so we're basically using people's stories to trace where they are in their own development and mirroring what we're offering them in the coaching process to bring more and more of the story out into play, and then helping them work with the narrative material and reconfigure it in a way that would allow them to actually gain some new insight or make some shifts in themselves. And so the model mirrors the structure of a story, the structure of a transition, and the flow that people go through when they're trying to make changes in their life. And so what that meant was these three bodies of work got integrated into one model. And then we started to add things like attachment theory and other bodies of work to kind of enrich our understanding of how that flow actually happens.
Yeah, and you mentioned the metaphor of the rite of passage, and you also use a metaphor in your book, which I really am interested in, that idea of thresholds or threshold.
Yes.
How does that come to play in the work that you do?
Well, in the model, there's between each phase, there's sort of a threshold, and it's basically what the person needs to cross over or resolve in order to move to the next phase. And so if somebody's so deep in grief or loss or confusion in that sort of situate phase, there's really not a lot of value in trying to get them to do anything or to set goals or any of that kind of stuff, because they're just not ready to cross that threshold to even admit that what's happened. They can't face that yet. So it's really just about attending to the human being and their needs. And similarly, if you move from the second to third phase, the second phase is still, it's much more of an internal process. It's still organized around the past and somewhat the present. Mm. And there needs to be a crossing of a threshold to the next phase, which means I'm willing to stop learning, stop exploring, stop discovering, take what I've gained and figure out now what I'm going to do differently for my future. Mm. And for a lot of people, they can get stuck in rumination because they are not willing yet to move. We're able to move from the past and towards the future and let go of that. And so it's basically just it's often a process. It's often experienced in the moment as a stark boundary between that was this and this is now. And so it's really, it's both the doorway and the means to cross the doorway to step into the next phase of your process.
And do you make that pretty visible to the people you're working with, or?
I do. We do it in both, I suppose, overtly and covertly. So, sort of subtly, we do it when, as I was joking with a colleague of mine a couple of days ago, the process is actually very Buddhist in a way, until it's not.
Buddhist how?
It's very much centered in the presence to the person. To the narrative material. It's non-directive. It's very much about holding space, using silence to guide the conversation, not your questions. It's really an unfolding kind of process. And I think one of the gifts that it brings to the work is that, unlike, say, Buddhist practices or mindfulness practices, it actually does believe that, or I do believe that, stories bring meaning to our life. And that, yes, stories confuse us and obfuscate reality and do all kinds of things that things like mindfulness can help with. But in reality, stories also have power and efficacy and agency and the like. And so we really just sit with people as they tell their story in a really powerful way. And then there's certain moments where there's an opening or there's a threshold that becomes available to them where we might step into that with a really provocative question or a deep inquiry or a deep reflection to help open up the possibility that was just presented in that story. And so we often then just use those spontaneous moments to help people cross thresholds without ever sort of marking it or doing anything about it that way. Mm. We just do that. And then in some of my workshops, we actually do create literal thresholds on the floor. And we get people to say, you're standing right here. What is this thing in front of you that's your thing to step over or through? And they have to sort of name that and declare that. And then we guide them through this process to actually step over to the other side to a new story with the condition that they really can't ever go back. This is a significant change for them. So this often shows up for them in terms of making decisions. And what the threshold then does is really focuses and accelerates the development so that we can get people to pretty significant movements in their life in fairly brief periods of time.
Wow. Okay. Before we go much further, can we talk about the four phases just so people have
sure.
an understanding? Maybe walk us through situate, number one, situate, number two, search, number three, shift, and number four, sustain.
Sure. So one of the sort of, I suppose, Buddhist-oriented parts of the process is that we don't generally set goals with people, and we certainly don't set them in the beginning.
Right.
And situate is only about meeting the other human being and making that connection and just helping them to be present to themselves, to be present to the moment in the session, to be present to their own stories. And so we're like in a story, it's like, it's once upon a time. And so what is the setting? Who is this person? Where are they at? How are they feeling? What's going on around them? And it really is, just about what is, that's it. And we don't try to go anywhere or change anything. And we find often, the funny phrase I use in the book about this is, I think of it as goal evaporation theory.
I like that. Yeah,
I do too. It's one of my favorites. And that I often find that a lot of the goals that people think they're bringing to coaching evaporate when they're actually just present to more of their own reality. And that they realize that those goals were often ones that were internalized from other people or for other reasons.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. I'm sure many of us can.
Yeah, right.
And so situate then is really, it's in the model, it's in the upper left quadrant. So four quadrants there, it's really about the past and the outer world. It's how things are right now and getting people to be present to how things are right now. Okay. And either because of their aspiration or because of something that's happened for them, they would like to change something about their current reality, or it's something about their reality has already changed. And so they go on a journey. And so the first sort of threshold they cross is around separation, leaving behind whatever it is that they are putting behind them to move forward. And this tends to move still in the past and somewhat the present into more of an internal process for most people. There are some, the search is really around what did they lose? What are the values that are now at risk for them? What is it that they need to discover, to learn, to make new sense of what's going on and how to best move forward? This is really about what if? What if I were to look at my story like this, or my life like this, or myself like this, or the other person like this? And it's a place where they start to confront what in rites of passage language we would think of liminal spaces, that space in between where right. you've left one thing, but you haven't arrived anywhere else yet. And it's a very scary time for a lot of people, particularly in organizations where there's a lot of pressure to perform. But this is really, these bottom two phases are really where all the work happens. And so this is really about what do you need to discover or face or confront or allow into your life in this phase that would enable you to figure out what it is you really need to satisfy the story and yourself and move forward.
Now, do you drive that process through inquiry? And
No, okay. Generally not. Generally, we just help people. The whole space is defined by the stories themselves. Okay. We don't bring in other data. We don't bring in other frames usually. We just help them to unpack the story itself and stay in what I call story time and story space. It's all everything's in the present moment. Even if part of the story's in the past, we bring it into the present moment. And so the questions are, and this is one of the huge things that a lot of coaches have a hard time with. The questions we ask in narrative coaching are not for our benefit at all. Our understanding is not relevant to their solution.
Hmm. I like that.
Which is completely contrary to most of us, which is we want to be clever and helpful, which is our noble desires. But in reality, the only function of our questions is to create new experiences for people and help them to get clarity for themselves. We don't need to understand what's going on for them at all. And so this is where silence and presence is really helpful. And so usually in the course of deepening their story, their telling of their story or stories, they start to get some clues about some things that are just not quite right. Maybe a gap between what they expected and what actually happened, or a gap between how they saw themselves and now how they see themselves. And so it's in those sort of gaps where the story is forming, and that's the space we want to hang out with them. And usually in that, a lot of the aha moments that are famous in coaching happen here, where they start to realize what this story was all about and why they were subconsciously choosing to tell it. And then we sort of pull that piece forward, sort of crossing the threshold to move to shift, which is now, it's a big leap for a lot of people because search can be both painful and very comfortable. It's like an itch, you know, we just can't stop scratching it. Right. But at some point you have to stop that and let it go and start to think about taking action. And so the shift phase is really around experimentation. What do we, in order to bring that little nub you just discovered to life, that insight to life, what are you going to have to do differently for yourself?
Okay.
And so shift is really a chance for people to experiment. And so, again, one of the differences between how I approach coaching and how it's often done is we tend to not ever set goals, and we certainly tend to minimize things we expect people to do after the session.
So you're not a big fan of homework or?
Well, I am, but it's only to reinforce what we've already done in the session.
Okay.
Because I believe, you know, for me, for most people, the coaching session is the safest, most supportive place they have in their life.
Right.
And so it's never going to get any better than that. I mean, they might have close friends that can offer the similar, and so whatever it is they want to be doing, so they want to be more, they want to speak up more often, or they want to have a stronger posture. They want to experience more intimacy in their life, you know, with a small I. Then I said, well, why not do that now? If, you know, I'm here, you're here, this is what you want, and you're afraid of it, or you're not sure about it, or you don't know, and well, there's no better place to learn than now. And so we create experiences for people using archetypes and other things for people to begin to experiment and get feedback in the moment. In my last program in the Netherlands a couple weeks ago, we had a guy who was extraordinarily accomplished, former military leader, now coach, who was trying to he wanted to present this idea to his boss for a new program. So I said, great, here you go, right now, tell me, I'm your boss.
Yeah, right.
And he's proceeded to try to teach us for like 10 minutes about why we should, why great this program was and what it was and why it mattered and blah, blah, blah. And after about 3 minutes, I just stopped him. I said, I don't need to know anymore, because what I want to know is why this program matters to you. Because if I don't know why it matters to you, then it's not going to matter to me. Hmm. And so he tried like three goes, and he just kept going back to his default, which is to try to persuade by educating. And so I just stopped him after shorter and shorter intervals and said, we'll call him Bob. Hmm. Bob, so why does this matter to you really? In your heart of hearts, why do you want to do this program? And he started to talk again. I said, just take a breath. Take a few breaths, actually. We had done some work on this already. But just really settle into yourself. And close your eyes. And just from your heart of hearts, why do you want to do this program? And some time went by and he was feeling very uncomfortable, and I just supported him to hold that anxiety. And I said to him, so when you're ready, just open your eyes and tell us why this matters to you so much. And he opened his mouth and he said, because from my time in the military, I saw how much pain people experienced because, and then he, in one sentence, described what his program was going to address.
Wow.
It was so moving. He himself started crying. Wow. I said, now I want to know about your program, because now you've showed up and I know why this matters to you, and therefore why it's going to matter to me, and why it's going to matter to the people who would want to come to your program. So shift is very much about, and we tend to focus on fewer things in our sessions because we want to go really deep on one or two core things that they can practice a number of times with feedback in the session until they can feel it in their bones. And then the sustain then is really then where you look at, okay, well, now you have to go home or go back to your desk or your job or your community. Where do you want to practice this first? Who's going to be the most supportive, the most engaged in this, who will love you for this, right? So we set up some assignments for them to go have those conversations, to try this out.
So this is really supporting these new intentions or
yes.
projects, programs, et cetera?
Yes.
Okay.
So I said, so when are you going to talk to your boss? Well, I've got a meeting with him on Friday. Are you willing to bring this up to him? Yes. What do you need to do to get ready for that? And he laid out a few ideas, and we sort of sculpted that a bit. And then I said, is there anything about those presentations you want to practice right now? And we give them that opportunity. And we also help them to recognize that not everybody's just going to be as thrilled with their new story as they are. And so we help them to begin to sort of scope out where some resistance or challenges might come from and how they want to choose to deal with those, which is usually to try to just hold them off rather than engage them, because they're still pretty fragile in their new sense of themselves or their new skills. And we don't want them trying to tackle difficult people yet. So we just want to give themselves safety so they can buy themselves some time. The homework is always in context of what they've already practiced in the coaching session.
Okay. And I get the sense that you start out in the situate phase, really less directive, but you scaffold into a more directive role
at times, but only the directive is not like go here,
right?
It's more like pay attention to this, which we really step into those sort of breaches in their story where there's a potential opening for their development, and we might just name that. And so one of the things that people notice about the way I work is contrary to this, because you're asking me questions, I don't tend to talk a lot in my sessions, and I tend to move my chair a lot depending on where I need to be relative to the person, the field between us and the story itself. So we actually get them to move around a lot. We use objects in the room. And when we teach this work, we do a lot of chair activities I've developed. And because we want people to break the grip of the story that they're stuck in right now and begin to imagine different possibilities about themselves as the author or actor in the story.
So is that where the kind of the Virginia Satir experiential and psychodrama kind of come into play in your work? Or
yeah, so there would be similars there. In the book, I talk about the ways in which, one of the things that's really important to me is to really honor my elders and honor others who have been following similar paths. And then to offer the reader some distinctions about where I've diverted from those paths and how I've positioned narrative coaching a bit differently. So, for example, one of the big things for me is that, obviously Virginia Satir was brilliant and just, a challenging person, but brilliant at what she did. And for me, a lot of those like psychodrama tend to have assigned roles, which we don't do, and they tend, they very much rely on expert facilitation.
Right.
Whereas I've taught narrative coaching to over 10,000 people inside companies, the vast majority of whom are not coaches. And we scale we shift the language slightly, so it's more familiar to them in a corporate environment, but the process is exactly the same. And we want them to recognize that you need to ethically be responsible for your own limitations and only go in conversations where you'll feel confident and equipped to go. And if things arise that are beyond you, then you have a duty to of care to refer people on. And you can learn how to do this at a basic level very quickly. Because the thing that people, I guess, really admire is that it feels like it's very integrative to them, where a lot of the stuff that they thought was important about coaching kind of drops away. And it really comes down to just a deeply human conversation.
Right. So you're really about moving away from that expertness. And
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you teach them to do that? I know in coaching, I think it's paradoxical, right? There's some idea that you're supposed to step into this kind of expertness, but you're moving away from that.
And I always have. I mean, I remember the first time I demonstrated the work in public when I was in Australia in 2006. And I'd done some small things before them as in the context of programs, but never as a separate workshop. And I did a demonstration up front afterwards, after my session, after my presentation. And then not too long after, they had a normal feature of their program, which was a master coach demonstrating what they did. And when I watched her, I thought, well, A, she's very good at what she does, and B, I don't do any of those things. And it was really eye-opening for me, because for the first time, I really started to appreciate, even in those early days, why what I was doing was different. So, for example, quite a few people in the audience noticed that I, at one point, several points in the conversation with this woman I was coaching, I stopped. I didn't ask her what seemed like the obvious next question. And they said, well, why did you stop? And I said, because she wasn't ready for that. She didn't want that. And I said, but she didn't say anything. How did you know that? And so I asked the woman, was that your experience? She said, yes, I'm very glad you didn't ask me those questions. A, I wasn't prepared to share, and B, they weren't really where I wanted to go anyways. And so I just started to realize that really it's not most coaching is often one question after another, sort of driving like cogs in a wheel this process forward. And I do the exact opposite. I just listen for what's present in the story. And then if there's a question about that that can improve on that silence, I might put it out into the field for the person to consider.
Yeah, and in one of your six narrative coaching principles, which I really appreciate, speak only when you can improve on silence.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so in regards to kind of maybe the different, going back to maybe some of the differences between narrative therapy and coaching, I did have one question, because you in the book say that narrative coaching attends to power through a lens of emergence rather than justice. And I know in therapy they tend to, especially, you know, like narrative therapy or some other models of therapy, are very interested in larger social context, dominant discourses, that kind of thing. But you're tending to power in kind of a different way. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So in my first career, I worked a lot with nonprofits. I worked with churches. I was involved in a couple of large scale peace and justice movements, particularly around issues in Central America, and helped write a little book about some of that. And so I completely get their passion for restorative justice kinds of approaches and equipping people to feel more agentic or authorial in their narrative, particularly if they've got they've been marginalized in their narrative, or right, they've got narratives that are sort of what's the word I'm looking for? I'm blanking on it, but anyways, what's the word I'm looking for?
Oppressed? Oppression?
Yeah, they've been made to feel wrong in some fashion. So I have great respect for what they're doing. And, you know, in terms of so many of the communities around the world, that, you know, both in terms of, you know, from anorexics to criminals to people in poverty, I think that's what they've been doing is great. I don't work a lot in that space anymore. And I find that sometimes they get really caught up in that sort of ethos, which was sort of what I experienced a lot of with the movements, that they were really focused on the negative. And rightfully so in some ways, but I didn't always think it was the best way forward. And you see now the opposite example in sort of what positive psychology has become, which wasn't what people like Abe Maslow or even Marty Seligman had in mind, but that's what it's become. And I'm more of a Jungian in that I look more at the whole and what psyche and soul need. I look at shadow. And so for me, I work a lot with contexts. I'm very sensitive to the narratives in which people are embedded that shape their language, that shape their reality, that shape their choices. So I don't want to minimize that. And unlike a lot of other coaching approaches, which are very individualistic, I do take a very socially oriented approach. Yeah. And I'm most interested in where is there power in this system that's available to this person. And so this is where that sort of Buddhist sort of orientation comes in, that we don't use frames like good and bad, because I don't find them very helpful.
Right.
Because today's good is tomorrow's bad and vice versa often.
Often.
And so we just help people hold space for their issue in a non-judgmental manner. And we just help them to pay attention to it, to notice kind of how it got to be that way, notice where there's opportunities for them to tell that story a bit differently and what that might bring to them. And so I'm more interested in where's the power available and how can we help that emerge and align with what the person is trying to accomplish.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. You mentioned something as well, that you're a Jungian, and that's yes. kind of interesting to me. I guess I'm a closet Jungian in some ways, but I've kind of been recently, and I'm going to go back to integration, how you've really used integration, and I'm going to use the word thresholds again, to taking
sure.
certain ideas and that maybe normally would not mix, right? But you're kind of, interested in these thresholds between these ideas, and that includes attachment, and then, some of the other things that you're bringing in. But I'm also interested in this Jungian. How does the Jungian approach kind of inform your work or what you do? And
well, I mean, it's where I draw some of the, we use a lot with archetypes. We do some things with the shadow. I used to teach week-long intensives in the shadow, which I loved. And so we incorporate some of those practices in the program. And so, for example, and so part of this is, thus we give credence to the story itself in narrative coaching. Hmm. And so we ask, what is this story trying to accomplish on the behalf of this person? Why is it showing up right now? And so it's a very Jungian sort of piece around looking at the whole soul issue, the issue of the psyche, which is in a funny way, hellbent on providing opportunities for us to grow up and mature, whether we want to or not. So it keeps presenting people that are difficult for us, or opportunities that are difficult, that present opportunities to really stretch ourselves. So, for example, I think it's changing now, which is wonderful. But for a while there was a lot of fairly naive view about strength. So we're supposed to just use our strengths or use them better. And
a lot of strength focus lately, right?
Yeah. And which I think, it's heading in the right direction. It's certainly far better than trying to change a weakness, which is impossible. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that, again, this is, I think, getting better now, but the reality was that it didn't really equip people to figure out what they were supposed to do with their strengths to be different. And so obviously over-applying them or misapplying them creates problems. So but it was often positioned as a thermostat. Well, it's too hot, just turn it down or turn it up, whatever the case may be. And that sort of binary piece just wasn't very productive, I found, for people. And, it's sort of a first blush. It's a first step. Being humorous is a great strength you have. However, there's times when you might want to dial that down. But beyond that, in terms of actually maturation as opposed to skill adjustment, people needed something more sophisticated to be able to know how to mature themselves. And so we have developed a process where we get people to work with one of their strengths that they want to adjust a bit and look at it, its shadow. And what are the energies in the shadow that they've suppressed that might actually have something to say about their strength? And so we use the shadow energy basically to temper the strength. So not only does it become more refined, but it becomes stronger and the person becomes more discerning in terms of how and when they apply it.
And you also referenced James Hillman in your book a few times.
Yes.
I've recently, the last several months, have kind of started to read him a little bit, starting with like healing fiction.
Uh-huh.
Can you say something about him, how he affects your work, or what your interest in him was?
Well, I always just found him fascinating. You know, he's sort of the quintessential post-Jungian.
Yeah.
I think he was very interested in sort of the issues of the soul, the issues of deeper development, the sort of the ways in which we try sort of trap people in therapy a bit. And I just liked him because he was a deep thinker, I thought. And
right.
He had this, he had this idea called the daemon, you know, this sort of this acorn theory of development, which I really enjoyed, which was, We look at development often as sort of an additive process. We do this, and then we do this, and we do this. And he said, yeah, but all along there's been this sort of this core of you that's been trying to get out and blossom and was there from the beginning. And so I always felt like Jung often talked about, you know, the first half of your life was largely defined by your birth and the last half of your life was largely defined by your death. And I think now, having crossed that threshold of I'm no longer in the first half of my life,
yeah,
unless I live to be really, really old,
right.
Then I can really get that. I think in some ways, Hillman was always, he was always in the second half of his life. I mean, I think he just was really trying to help psychology, and even Jung's, the interpretation of Jung, to move into this, sort of those deeper realms. And so, you know, you would know this from your own studies, but there are certain authors that you really can't quite put a finger on specifics they gave you, but
right.
You just know that you're a far better practitioner because you've read them and thought with them and, you know, and wrestled with their ideas. And I would say he's very much like that for me.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is, but I was just kind of drawn to him, and
I
picked up Healing Fiction, and I found a book, Powell's in Portland, of all places. Him doing some interviews, and you said he's just a really deep thinker, and he really is, and I really kind of appreciate that about him. So it's one of those guys you get to kind of wrestle with those ideas, like you said. But
yes,
okay. So now I think it's probably time to move on to maybe what people might be interested in, the business of coaching, right? How to maybe do some practice building. But you know, we had an interesting kind of email exchange when we were setting up this interview, and it was around, you know, this idea that a lot of coaching now is very personality driven,
mm-hmm.
Rather than kind of fundamental driven or even practice driven. And
mm-hmm.
In some ways, I wouldn't even, by looking at some of the stuff going on, I wouldn't even know what their theory of change is or these kinds of
things. Right.
So it's just more about, hey, I'm really, you know, great on social media, so whatever.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about that, or about how what's the state of the coaching world right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of, there's been a lot of development, I suppose, at both ends of that spectrum. I think, you know, we have more and more, you know, doctorates being written on research related to coaching. We have more and more graduate level programs on coaching. We have more and more people who have now taken enough training in a variety of things to become quite masterful at what they do. And, you know, we're slowly getting, I'm working on with two colleagues, sort of the definitive anthology about coaching and research right now. And so I feel like we're slowly getting to the place where, you know, we have a pretty substantive, the beginnings of a substantive body of work around coaching. So I think that's the good news. And the other sort of good news, but also challenging news, is that now pretty much everybody's a coach.
Right.
And so the word doesn't mean much anymore. And so companies are sometimes defaulting to single source providers, or they're looking for accreditations, which for the most part from the associations don't frankly mean a lot.
Right.
It means something, but not as much as we would like them to be, and certainly not as much as you'd find in other professions. And so for me, I go back to, we all should operate within our zone of competence. I also believe that coaching at one level is a democratic activity. That one can choose to make it its one craft for use in whatever one is doing. But ultimately, again, it's a very human set of skills and practices. So for me, I think coaching will increasingly, as I've argued for years in the literature, will increasingly be seen as a verb. It is a verb. It will be seen that way, I think, in terms of this is a way of operating. Whether you're talking to your child, your team member, whomever. And some people will opt to make it a formal part of their practice and will identify themselves as coaches. Other people will just offer coaching as one of the modalities by which they deliver their services. And the rest of us will just sort of, it will advance our understanding of how does one have powerful conversations with people. And so for me, my own personal interest or professional interest is to continue to support organizations and practitioners to advance their thinking about coaching. And that's why I run my professional development programs. That's why I consult with organizations to sort of upgrade how they use their coaching services and programs. And at the same time, I'm starting to, with a couple other colleagues, starting to explore what comes after coaching. Where's this all this going? And so we're getting some really inklings about what's coming on the backside of coaching.
Yeah, can you speak to that a little bit? Because that was going to be one of my next questions. What do you think the future holds?
Well, I think for me, and not in a bad way even, but I think coaching has very much been dominated by psychology. And it's very understandable why that would be. I mean, there's obviously a lot of extraordinary fits, and it's the most logical place for coaching to land as it tried to find a home in academia, for example.
Right.
But, a significant portion of coaching, graduate coaching programs, actually probably almost all of them, most of them are not in psychology departments. They're in education departments, business departments, executive education departments. And so I think part of what's going to come after coaching is a practice that's more integrative in nature that includes other disciplines besides coaching. I mean, besides psychology, other modalities besides talking. Because I think the complexity of what people are seeking help with cannot be addressed solely through verbal psychological practices. So for example, just in some small ways, we've in the last couple of years started to incorporate somatic activities in our programs, accessing the body in terms of what its contribution is to the story and to the story's resolution. We've started to use more overt, sort of non-conscious, more Jungian type approaches to tap those aspects of our psyche to get them into the picture. And there's some other sort of physical modalities we're exploring about how to help people get to the whole story faster and to access parts of themselves that are not accessed through language.
Interesting.
And then the complete other end of the spectrum, in terms of thinking about how to streamline the development process in coaching. I also, a couple of years ago, did a bunch of study and teaching a bit on design thinking. How do people prototype fast and experiment and fail fast and get something out fast? I said, well, why could we not apply the same structure to coaching? And so the four quadrant names, not so much the four S's, but the sort of what if is, what if, what matters and what works, it comes right out of design thinking. And so we're, again, trying to help people reconfigure, in a sort of an alchemical way, deconstruct their story into its core elements, burn them down to its essence, their essences, reunite them into some new third, if you will, and then figure out what that might mean for you in terms of benefit at the end. And so I found design thinking was a really powerful little simple frame about how to do that. And so that's what sort of prompted me to think that we could accelerate coaching. And so most of the time when I'm doing demonstrations, they're usually less than 10 minutes because we don't need much more than that.
So you'll demonstrate the design thinking model? Or?
Well, the narrative coaching model, but the design thinking enables me to, it's a funny combination of sort of Buddhism and design thinking.
Which appeals to me.
So. Yeah, but what it does, I mean, I never really thought of it quite that way, but until now, but it's really, so when we go to traditional psychotherapy, it's very helpful in that situate space because it takes a while, particularly if there's a lot of wounding around whatever issue you've brought or a lot of confusion or difficulty in your environment, where being held in that situate space is just lovely. And it really does create a container which you begin to blossom out and really get a sense of what's going on and who you are. And we do some of that in even in narrative coaching. There's other ways to get at those things when the person is ready, for which things like design thinking can be quite helpful in just like trying to go right into what is the nub of this? What is at the heart of this issue that if I could unlock that with them and help them find that for themselves, then everything else becomes possible.
That's wonderful. Okay, so how would people find you and do a workshop, or if they want to learn more about narrative coaching, how would they do that?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. So we'll have our new website up by the end of this week, and several things become available to people. One is they can go on Amazon right now and buy the book. It's always a good place to start. In late January, we're going to be starting an online course based on the book. And so there's information that will go up on the site about that, so they can find out more and register for that if they want. Right now, I'm only doing in-person programs on the West Coast of the U.S. and in Europe.
Hmm. Do you have any planned on the West Coast at least?
I will next year. Okay. I'm meeting with, I did my inaugural, well, I did a pilot in San Francisco a few years ago, but I did my first full lab in Portland, where I lived for a long time, this summer. And so I'm actually meeting with that group over the Christmas holidays to kind of reflect on what they did and to begin to find out who would help me organize some more programs. And I've also been in contact with a few people in the Bay Area and one actually in your neck of the woods down by San Diego.
Yeah, great.
So she and I are actually talking in a couple of weeks about having her help me organize some things here on the West Coast. So the best thing, buy the book. If you're interested in the course, which is an opportunity to go deeper into the material in the book, ask questions like you've been asking and sort of form a little community around that. That would be great. And then if you want an in-person experience, which are load, when we do our programs in the Netherlands, we do it at a innovation lab because it's just really cool facilities to run this program. Mm. And there's glass walls, glass windows between the hallway and us. And people walk by and they look at it. There's really puzzled look on their faces because we could be doing a really playful activity. It's because we focus a lot on what we call serious play, and they might see in one half of the room someone crying, and in the other half of the room someone laughing their head off because they just fell off the chair. They're laughing so hard, and they get very confused. Like, how can both of these happen at the same time, doing the same thing in the same workshop? Mm. And for me, it's just. The lab, the in-person labs are just great because they really provide the opportunity, even more so than the online program, to help people feel into this work and experience this work.
Yeah, that's great. I hope to see you at one soon.
Yes.
Okay, so, and that's the, if you Google the website, Center for Narrative Coaching.
Yeah, it's www.narrativecoaching.com.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll provide links on our show notes. So listeners, you'll be able to get them there too. So Dr. Drake, I really appreciate you taking the time, and coming out and onto the Radical Therapist podcast. It was a fascinating conversation, and I'm going to continue to be paying attention to what you're doing. It sounds very exciting and new and really kind of challenging. I mean, I really like what you're doing with the integration, and it's just kind of been really fascinating to me. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, that's our show, and I want to again thank Dr. David Drake for taking time.
This is the Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
RadicalTherapist.com. You can find the website there. Also, Google the Radical NarrativeCoaching.com, and you'll find them there as well. So, please reach out to us. Talk to us. You can do that through our email, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We have an Instagram site, The Radical Therapist, and we can be found on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. We do appreciate your engagement with the show. And having said that, we also have new stickers. Some new stickers came in, so I'm excited that we got rid of a lot of them. A lot of you requested stickers. Thank you for that. And they're showing up all over the world, and that's exciting. But we have some new stickers, so if you'd like some Radical Therapist stickers, please shoot me an email. I will mail them out to you right away, get them out to you so you can have them. And as always, we appreciate your pictures, letting us know where they end up or where you are at. That's exciting to us. So, stay tuned, keep listening. As always, go on to iTunes, please, and subscribe to the show. Even leave us a review if you have a little extra time. We appreciate that. We have received a new review, and I appreciate that. Thank you. So, yeah, please support the show. And my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.